Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, did you know that it was possible to work for Goldman Sachs and live in California?
I didn't. It sounds like a pretty good deal.
There's only, as far as I know, there's only one person that has that gig, and he's going to be on Trillions today. Who is he?
Cole Feinberg. So he's somebody that I originally met when he was at BlackRock, which I guess is, we'll find out, that's probably why he was in San Francisco or California to begin with. They have a huge San Fran office there. But I met him at BlackRock, and then he moved to Goldman when they started their ETF business, I want to say like 6 years ago-ish. And they have been very successful. It's interesting. Goldman is just thought of as this monster Wall Street company that has a lot of power and influence. But you know, when they came into ETFs, it's a meritocracy. It's a terror dome for them too. And so there was nothing given. They had to earn all of it. And it, you know, they've had some successes, some not so successful. So even for them, they've had to sort of start from scratch and be a newbie in the ETF industry. So we have one of their funds that caught our radar in the past week was GSLC. We've been watching this one since it came out. It's the active beta ETF. It's basically a ETF that has value, quality, momentum, and low vol all packaged together. Those are the factories. And then it just hit $10 billion, which puts it in the top 100 biggest ETFs. Now, it's very rare for anyone outside of BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street to be in the top 100. And to do it without doing like a plain beta ETF, you know, like a regular index, to do something that's a little active-ish, is a real feat. And so I figured the $10 billion we would, you know, it was a good excuse to talk to Goldman.
Also joining us is Katie Greifeld, who's an ETF reporter for Bloomberg News. This time on Trillions, Goldman's ETF guy. Cole, welcome to Trillions.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, I got to ask you, are you the only Goldman employee in California? Did I get it right?
Not exactly right. We have a pretty good presence in both Los Angeles and San Francisco. There's not a lot of asset management, though. There's a good amount of private wealth, investment banking, and some other divisions. So I am one of the lucky ones on the asset management side.
And I have to ask, because you're there right now and the whole West Coast seems to be on fire, how are you faring with the wildfires?
I appreciate you asking. It's scary. Bright orange skies and lots of smoke. And I think the thing I'll say is we're very fortunate to be safe where we are in the Bay Area. We live in the East Bay, and somewhat fortunate also that at least during this pandemic, we're not expected to be in crossing bridges and all that other good stuff, right? So working from home is a benefit as well. But the real thing that I would want to say is just incredibly grateful and thankful for firefighters and all the men and women out there who are working, you know, literally days and nights for weeks in a row to keep us safe. It's yeoman's work that they do. It's incredible. And we're all very fortunate to have them working as hard as they are.
So I got to ask about this product that Eric mentioned in the intro, GSLC, which has just been on a tear for you guys at Goldman. Can you describe it? Because it sounds like a smart beta fund, basically, right? Is that how you describe it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, look, I think the Goldman brand name within smart beta is active beta. Eric alluded to the four factors in our offering: value, quality, low volatility, and momentum. So what we do is we equally weight each of those factors when we rebalance on a quarterly basis. And the reason I think that's important actually goes back to the naming convention, right? Active beta. It's a little bit of an oxymoron. Beta, you get some of the traditional benefits with GSLC and our active beta suite that you do with pure passive, right? Tradability, transparency, low cost, tax efficiency, benchmark awareness. But you also get some of the, what I would say are kind of key attributes of active management, which is, you know, leveraging factors and kind of tried and true methods to try to achieve a little bit of alpha, you know, to try to take a little bit of volatility off the table. And I think we've been successful, not to break our arms, you know, patting ourselves on the back, But I think we've been successful in raising assets because the products have done exactly what they're supposed to do, right? Low cost, 4 years straight of alpha relative to the index, taking vol off the table. Investors have taken notice and we've been the beneficiary of flows as a result.
So Cole, got to ask, looked at the holdings, you guys are cheap, but the holdings basically kind of look like S&P 500 holdings, and I can get S&P 500 stuff cheaper elsewhere. Why would I invest in GSLC when I can do something like S&P 500 elsewhere?
It's a good question. And I would say two things. One is you can't get it much cheaper elsewhere, right? GSLC is 9 bips. You can't get too much lower than that. But I think you bring up a good point, which is, you know, look, by design, as I mentioned, it's benchmark aware, right? We look at incorporating the factors that we talked about, but we do so equally, right? So we are, in my view, there's three ways that you can construct a multi-factor product. You can do what we'll call factor timing, right? Hey, in Q3, we're overweight momentum and underweight value, as an example, or vice versa, or whatever it may be. Number two is you can, you know, kind of put what I would call persistent overweights in place, something like the FAMA French model, which is well followed, and a lot of ETFs out there, you know, kind of benchmark to a FAMA French type of model, where something in the neighborhood of about 70% is in value as a result. You got a lot of eggs in one basket. With either of those, you're making bigger bets relative to the benchmark. With GSLC, to your point, Joel, I think you hit the nail on the head, you're not taking as big of a bet, right? We're making very small tweaks to the market cap weights. Our view is on that, I think, look, we like market cap weighting. We just don't necessarily believe that the size of the company should be the only input into how much of it you own. So while there is, like you said, definitely, you know, pretty good overlap, call it low active share relative to the benchmark, you'll see a lot of the same names, but different weights in those names, right? So where Apple and Microsoft and Amazon are the biggest holdings in the S&P, they are some of our biggest holdings as well. They're just not as significant because of, in currently anyways, right, modest underweights based on how they score in those factors. And so, you know, and in reverse, when you look at the bottom of the index, the very few, you know, the very smallest weighted names at the bottom of the index, News Corp and, you know, some names like that, they start out at such small weights. But if they score well based on our factor kind of ranking, you're going to see some pretty good overweight. So again, you're going to see a lot of the same names, but with different weights to how much of those you own. And the idea is, we think, you know, look, if companies show the attributes of those factors, we want to have a little bit more of it, call it a modest overweight. Where companies do not show those attributes, of course, we're going to have a modest underweight. And so small tweaks to all of the names rather than big tweaks to some of the names is kind of the way I like to think about it.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about benchmark aware, and this ETF, I'm going to actually go out on a limb here and say this is really the future of active management. I wrote a Bloomberg opinion piece about 3 years ago. I want to say I called this, actually, where I referred to this ETF as the T2000 Terminator, you know, from Terminator 2, the liquid nitrogen one that they send from the future to try to kill the other Terminator. Anyway, long story short, it's very futuristic to me because it is using quant research, right? It's got value, growth, all the stuff, and it does it all in one shot. It doesn't pick one, because I think advisors maybe don't know which one to pick at what time. But here's the key thing to me, which I think is might be a little cynical, which is you get Goldman's name, but for Vanguard's fees. And I do think if it didn't charge 9 bips and you charge 30, it would struggle more. I think there's a real priority for cheap. And I just want to ask you this, is that I give Goldman and JP Morgan for that. The Wall Street banks have been really good about just going there quickly and ripping the Band-Aid off in terms of having some products that are what we call dirt cheap. What was that like, that decision to go there immediately? Because you see like some of the bigger mutual fund legacy firms coming in, they're all 30 to 60 bips. You came in at 9 with some pretty secret sauce kind of stuff here. What was behind that?
Yeah. It's a great point, and I think it's a really important one as to also why we've been successful with the asset raise, right? Which is, let's just take cost off the table, right? We think this is a scale game. You know, when you think about competitor pure passive offerings, the obvious behemoth in U.S. large cap is SPY, right? And SPY is also 9 bips. So basically, you're paying the same freight, but you're getting opportunity for a little more bang for your buck. Again, whether that's alpha, less vol, ideally both, and that's been the result for our shareholders. And so what I would say is the logic being it being a scale game, and I think going back to the logic as to why that's helped us raise assets is couple the low cost with the benchmark awareness, right? That allows advisors to think about it as core. And
yeah, that's, you can go after more of the portfolio, and they have a fear of getting fired, I think, or at least getting feedback from their clients. So why is this underperforming? GSLC will never really stray from the index too much because it's got a lot of the index in there, or the S&P rather.
That's right.
Cole, can you rewind the clock and like put us in the room? Did you have the dry erase pen and go up to the board and we're like 9 basis points and like,
yeah,
underline?
Like who got that through the management committee? Because I have to feel like Goldman would be like, we're not selling something for 9 pips.
You know, it's really, I learned this after having joined the firm a little over 5 years ago. The mandate within all of GSAM, and this is for our mutual funds and our ETFs, is to be below the average price of the Morningstar peer universe. So where I don't necessarily think folks always think, you know, low cost provider when they hear the words Goldman Sachs, in the case of our asset management business, it really is applicable. And you know, I won't let you maybe all the way behind the curtain as to what the whiteboard looked like in that room, but I think the discussion ended in a really smart place where we realized that the go-to-market strategy and the ability to compete with, you know, the big three, as you like to refer to them, Eric, right? And I think that's spot on. In order to compete, we needed to be really thoughtful on price. And that feedback has been really obvious from clients. And again, in the end, via their dollars going towards these products, and it's proven really successful.
Well, I wanted to ask about the inflows. They've been very steady all year. You know, GSLC has taken in cash every month. I think August was particularly strong. And I know that model portfolios are a focus for GSAM. Goldman bought S&P's model portfolio business last year. So wrapping that all together, I wanted to ask, you know, how important have model flows been for GSLC's growth? And if not model flows, you know, where is that demand coming from?
Yeah, it's a great question. So specific to our models business, you know, we do have some of the kind of GSAM models incorporating GSLC and our other ETFs. Really candidly, I think we've been really thoughtful there too. Our models are not chock full of exclusively Goldman offerings, right? So we're thoughtful about where we don't have offerings, right? We have 20 or 25 ETFs. We don't have the kind of catalog of ETFs that some of the competitors do. And we're really thoughtful about incorporating our peers, right, and other issuers into our models where it makes sense, where it's the right exposure. So I'd start there. In terms of the flows generally this year and kind of historically into GSLC, we've been really fortunate that it's a very wide swath of, you know, call it investor types. Obviously, you know, approvals at all of the wirehouse platforms has been helpful and certainly extremely helpful in the early days. You know, across RIAs and independent broker dealers, we've seen tremendous flow. And more, we're also, you know, involved with institutional clients and bank trust departments and, you know, key platforms and so forth and other models, external model providers where we've seen a lot of growth. And I think success begets success, assets beget assets, liquidity begets liquidity, right? And we've leveraged that into being able to have kind of more and more conversations with different client types. I would kind of focus on institutional, especially there, right? Where you hit kind of key milestones in terms of asset levels and all of a sudden pension plans, be it public or corporate, you know, insurance companies, hedge funds, all kinds of different investors have taken notice. And as a result, we are very widely held across a number of, you know, client types.
You know, you talk about fees and costs. Obviously, it's a huge thing in the ETF world. I give you guys credit for actually forcing the cost fee war that kind of broke out in ESG. You came out with Just. It's the Goldman Sachs Just Large Cap Equity ETF, 20 bips. At the time, I think it might have been the cheapest or close to it. This is before Vanguarded that category. But anyway, I want to also talk about this ETF a little bit. You teamed up with Paul Tudor Jones, the billionaire hedge fund manager. And I actually like this because I do find that there's a disconnect between like what like hardcore ESG people who live in Manhattan think and like regular Americans, you know, that sort of gap that we have in the country. And Just polls America for what they want out of companies and then invest that way. And thus, it owns a company like Exxon and Amazon, which can be screened out of some of the other systems. Can you talk about this alternative approach to ESG?
Yeah, I'm really excited about Just. You know, the issues we measure and how we prioritize them, I think, are really important. So based on the most comprehensive surveys literally ever conducted, we engage about 72,000 people since inception, and you know, call it about 15 to 20,000 people a year to identify what the most important issues are regarding kind of just business behavior, right? So despite kind of the current narrative of a nation divided, we find that Americans across age, gender, partisanship, you know, ideologies, income, agree on the steps that corporations need to take to act more equitably. And we asked, you know, we ask in these surveys, Just Capital does, and then we leverage that index that they've created. We've asked the American public to kind of prioritize, you know, what is it that corporations need to do? What is just business behavior? And, you know, the results are we've identified the order of importance, really kind of seven key issues that I'll touch on really quickly: workers, customers, products, what kind of products are these companies, you know, bringing to market, environment, community, jobs, and then finally kind of management and shareholders. And so, you know, we take all these inputs and deliver what I think is really unique in the ESG space, which is a benchmark neutral, a sector neutral exposure to the Russell 1000. So basically with Just, you own 500 names out of the 1,000 names in the Russell 1000, the idea being the 500 that you own are all of the above average names based on all those inputs and how they rank. And I think it's really interesting, right? So the bottom line, right, to compare to the corporations that are excluded, the companies that are included, right? So the Just 500 relative to the Russell 1000, the 500 that make the cut are, they pay 33% more to their median US worker. They're 10 times more likely to have conducted gender pay analyses. They employ 38% more workers in the US. They use less water, they use less fuel, they use less electricity, they emit fewer greenhouse gases, they give more to charity. So the result of all that, you add it all up, and I think it's really compelling. What's interesting is on average, you see about a 7% higher ROE. You see about a 7% higher return on equity in the names that make the cut into Just relative to the names that kind of don't make the cut. So to your point, Eric, I want a case in point because I think this is really interesting, right? You talked about how other issuers will maybe, you know, kind of very specifically exclude energy as an example. Well, let's just, you mentioned Exxon. Let's just use Exxon and Chevron as a really quick example. If Exxon and Chevron are the only two names in the benchmark, and we're just going to keep one of them, well, one of them is doing more in terms of, you know, giving back to their community. One of them is doing more in terms of research and development of solar and, you know, renewable energy and so forth. And so it's all relative. They get ranked versus each other. And the one that's doing a better job quite simply gets, you know, remains in the index. And the result, I think, is compelling because you get low cost U.S. large cap core exposure to the Russell 1, but you also kind of scratch that ESG edge.
Eric, you're such a ESG skeptic.
Yeah, thank you for not saying hater. I don't hate it. I I just find it's active management, and you need to know that.
Does the framework that Cole has laid out for just intrigue you? What do you make of it?
I like it better because also companies like Exxon could very well be part of the future in terms of providing some of the clean energy solutions. I'm generally of the feeling that demand follows supply, and that if you change your life as a consumer, that's where most of your ESG focus should be. The companies will follow you. If you stop demanding gasoline, Exxon's is going to start selling, you know, the clean energy stuff. I don't know we should beat up companies for just servicing demand in a legal way. That said, if you are into ESG and you want to invest this way, I like Just. I think treating workers and employees is probably the most important thing for me too. I think companies can be greedy, corporations, and if you're rewarding the ones that are nicer to their employees, especially massive companies that employ like tens of thousands of people, I like that. I think for most people, that might be more important than, say, climate change.
Can I add something in there? Because I totally agree with everything you said there, Eric, and I would just say it's intuitive that if a company is treating its employees and shareholders and, you know, customers better, you would expect that probably more talent, be it kind of coming out of college or transitioning to a different kind of career path or whatever it may be, it's intuitive that somebody would want to go work at a firm like that. So you're going to probably acquire and keep better talent. And as a result, you're probably going to see better performance. So I think that you could almost make the argument that there's like a just alpha that exists. And I'll button that up by saying since inception, Just has outperformed its benchmark. And year to date, it's actually been really pretty compelling. So, you know, I do think it's really an interesting story.
So, Cole, I want to talk about the opposite of ESG, which is hedge funds. You have a really interesting product in your lineup, GVIP, which is the Goldman Sachs Hedge Fund Industry VIP and ETF, which I think is interesting because it doesn't try to replicate hedge fund strategies per se. Instead, it combs through 13F filings and tries to identify the favorite stocks among hedge funds. But I wanted to ask, you know, hedge funds on average haven't really done that well this year. They were up about 2% in the first 8 months of 2020. That's according to hedge fund research, which is kind of surprising since, you know, we've got volatility out the wazoo. You know, you have countries with different outlooks, you know, where they are and controlling the virus, and hedge fund managers just haven't shown up. And I do want to make the point that GVIP is actually up 18% year to date. It's beating the S&P 500, which is up less than 5%. But, you know, given that hedge fund managers haven't really done this year in a year they should have shined, is that a marketing challenge for a product like this?
It is a challenge. I think it's a really good question. I think it is a challenge, to be really candid. You would think performance that you referenced, right? I mean, it's not just beating the index. It's 3x the S&P year to date or something to that tune. You know, what's interesting is when you get under the hood, why that's happening, right? I think often it goes, you know, maybe unnoticed. But with GVIP, we're only giving you exposure to what hedge funds are doing on the long side of their books, right? So we kind of take a look at what are the most widely held holdings across a very large universe of hedge funds. And it gives you the opportunity. And then we give you exposure to, you know, what you get with GVIP is 50 stocks equally weighted at 2% each, where what you hold are the 50 stocks that are most widely held across that hedge fund universe. So you get kind of a not that concentrated kind of position. But importantly, you're only looking at the long side, right? And so often, I think what goes unnoticed, as I was getting ready to say, is hedge funds often make their money on the long side, right? The short side of the book can sometimes be where they have misses. When the short side of the book is wrong, that doesn't negatively affect the long side of the book. And GVIP is exclusively tracking the long positions. And you know, it's proven with an index track record that's now something in the neighborhood 12 or 13 years, and the ETF with 4 or 5 years now, you know, the performance has spoken for itself.
I want to follow up on GVIP while I have you. So the SEC is considering changing 13F disclosure rules. You might see fewer institutions, you know, filing each quarter. I'm curious how that would affect GVIP if you're not, if you don't have that data to pull from. How do you construct your holdings?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting question. What's as we've kind of navigated this potential decision, right, from the SEC to remove the mandate of asset managers and hedge funds and others having to report their holdings. I think it's still, the reporting will still account for over 90% of total assets held in the US. But I think less than 10% of asset holders will have to report anymore. So it's kind of an interesting kind of 90-10 rule there. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I don't pretend to be an expert on the subject, but my guess is that does not end up happening, to be really honest with you. I think the transparency that it offers is a benefit to investors. And especially in ETF land, we know what a benefit transparency is. I have a hard time believing that the SEC and any other powers that be are going to look to actually take transparency off of the table. So I'm hopeful that it doesn't happen. It's beneficial to us as an industry, and I think it's beneficial to end clients as well to know, you know, who owns what.
And Cole, real quick, I got to bring this up. Cole was on ETF IQ like a year ago, and we talked GVIP, and I compared it to Buzz, which is the ETF that scrapes Twitter for stock picks. And Buzz was sticking it to GVIP, and I said, what's a bunch of people on FinTwit can beat the hedge funds? That question was not in the prep note, so he still hates me for that. But I want to just follow up here and say that GVIP has caught up. It is now tied with the Twitter ETF. And so anyway, just to give GVIP its due, it's tied with the FinTwit crowd.
The small-ish but growing firm based in Canada who managed Buzz actually reached out to me to see if there was a way we could partner up on some marketing opportunities. So, No good deed goes unpunished. It was a good conversation. I appreciated it. I appreciate it as always, Eric. Good to keep me on my toes.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about things that you can maybe control a little bit more than what the SEC decides to do. And I want to bring it back to like what you think is capable of being innovated in the ETF space going forward. You know, we've talked about GSLC a little bit and sort of what you guys brought to bear there. We've had Kathy Wood on the podcast before and seen what she's been able to accomplish with ARK, which is a real innovative way of playing with ETFs as a wrapper and an active strategy. I'm curious, how do you compete with that? And where else do you think we can innovate in ETFs going forward? Is it just more themes, more thematic stuff, or is there real innovation to be tapped into?
You know, the direction I'd like to go with the answer to the question is really on fixed income, Joel. I think that, you know, when you look at the world of ETFs, equity ETFs make up about something in the neighborhood of 6 or 7% of the total equity market. Fixed income ETFs make up less than 1% of the total bond market. So I think there's a lot of room to run. And I think historically also clients, you know, be it certain asset classes or sub asset classes, think that active managers can do better in certain places, you know, less efficient marketplaces and so forth. Fixed income has historically been one of those places, right? I want an active manager for fixed income because, you know, that manager, he or she can weed out the bad stuff or whatever it may be. Well, now what we're seeing, and we certainly have some offerings that do this as well across our, what we branded our access suite with our fixed income ETFs, but we put some kind of liquidity screens, technical screens, fundamental screens in place, call it in the end, smart beta fixed income.
Staying on the innovation theme, I wanted to ask about active non-transparent funds, or as I know this podcast likes to call them, ANTs. I know that Goldman has filed for an ANT fund. I'm curious, you know, just in looking across the ETF landscape and where there's still innovation to be had, I mean, where do ANTs factor into that conversation? Or do you see fixed income as the bigger opportunity here?
You know, that's a tough one. I think that there are benefits to different parts of ETF structure, right? And what gets put into active non-transparent, what gets put into traditional kind of 40 Act, You know, I think it remains to be seen about a tremendous amount of success there, right? And I will just say, I think if it's good for the end client, it's good, right? And that's kind of the way we think about it. And, you know, if we have demand from clients, we want to have solutions for our clients. And I'll maybe just leave that one there.
I think the answer is going to struggle. I know, Cole, you can't really say that, but active stock picking, it's tough. I think the new active is what we discussed. It's smart beta, like GSLC. It's ESG, and it's thematics. These are more rule-based, cheaper, new. They're all active. I mean, they're just kind of not active under another name. But anyway, speaking of non-active, which is the beta, you guys came out with really these beta, Vanguardian-type beta ETFs called, actually, it's like a market beta. So basically, we call them the core. These are the things that go in the core of your portfolio. They'd compete with IVV or SPY. GSUS is one of them, right? So you look at the performance, it's basically the same thing. I frequently refer to these as the McDowell's ETFs. Remember that Coming to America, where it's like basically the S&P 500, but like tiny little tweaks. Like instead of the golden arches, it's the golden arcs. And so, you know, JP Morgan has some, Bank of New York has some, you guys have some. It's smart. I mean, why not? You've got a built-in client base. And if a client, an advisor, needs just basically like U.S. equity beta, you can use yours instead of going to Vanguard or BlackRock, which I think could be some natural headwind to their juggernaut growth, which arguably could be somewhat good because they're taking in so much of the cash. Is that really what they're there for? Is to say, hey, look, we've got that for any of your clients or customers that have portfolios. You can then plug in GSUS instead of IVV.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, you know, look, we didn't bring them out to compete with ourselves, but what, again, just going back to the theme of client feedback, right? We have ESG. We obviously have the very successful GSLC and the other, you know, offerings in the active beta suite. That said, we have plenty of clients, you know, and opportunities out there who have said, you know, we're just not interested in active beta or kind of anything that's not just benchmark hugging. We have plenty of folks who have told us that they're not yet ready, if you will, or maybe they don't believe in the factors or whatever the case may be. And so we want to bring solutions to all parties. And by bringing, you know, GSUS and, you know, the others, we've, I think, really helped clients, by offering a solution that they didn't otherwise have, at least not from us. Right. And so, there are plenty of good partners who want to do business with us and, but they don't want to necessarily make a leap that they're uncomfortable with. And so again, all driven by client demand, we brought these products to market to, you know, to kind of scratch that itch for those clients. And, you know, look, I think the active beta suite, the GSLC, the GEM for emerging markets, the GSIE for international developed, those will continue to be, in my opinion, the bellwethers of our product lineup. But, you know, if clients, it's all about options, right? We now have a more robust menu from which clients can select.
Did you expect, Eric, to transition from Coming to America to ETFs? Did you see that one coming?
I didn't exactly see that one coming. I was going to drop
I only give Cole half of what we're going to ask him because you don't want to have the whole thing scripted.
Okay, Cole. I'm going to ask you a question that I ask a lot on Trillions, and I'm going to preface it with a caveat, which is you can't pick one of your own. What is your favorite ETF ticker?
That's a good question, man. I do like one of ours, but I won't go with a you know, against the rules plug. This is silly, but one of my favorite ones has always been Moo, the VanEck agribusiness. Or agriculture. Yeah, that's a pretty good one. Ticker symbol recognition matters, right? I mean, a good ticker is really, really helpful.
Cole Feinberg, thanks so much for joining us on Trillions.
Had a ball. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you'd like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. You can find Katie at Kay Greifeld. And you can find Cole at Cole Feinberg and Goldman Sachs at Goldman Sachs. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.